So now we'll make a start, and can I introduce Alistair McBay? Great pleasure to have Alistair with us. He's a spokesman for the National Secular Society and a long-term member of the British Humanist Association. Great pleasure to have him with us, and can I ask you to welcome him now as he addresses us.
Good evening, thanks very much. I'm a bit fluey and the paracetamol is kicking in, so apologies if I get out of breath or if I have to refer to notes more than I usually would. Is faith in God a delusion? Well, let's deal with another delusion first. My opponent tonight, who I count as a friend, doesn't have faith in God as his biggest delusion. His biggest delusion is he thinks that Dundee will be playing SPL football again next season. Now, you couldn't beat the mighty Pars with 10 men a couple of weeks ago, so I think you've got another delusion to sort out there, David. Now, the danger of the discussion tonight is that I rehash what Dawkins wrote in here, which I don't think is his best work, and then David stands up and rehashes what he wrote in here, which may or may not be his best work. It's the only one I've read, so I wouldn't know. I don't think that would be particularly interesting or entertaining. One thing I think, though, is nothing's going to be resolved tonight. I think in 1,000 years' time, we'll still be debating this. I think I will still hold the position, or future generations of me will hold the position that I hold. I think Jews will still be waiting for the Messiah to come for the first time. I think Christians will be waiting for him to return. I think Muslims will still be telling us that he's not coming. And I think future generations of Robertsons will still be waiting for Dundee to get promoted back to the SPL. So, you know, nothing's going to happen. But you never know. You never know. Last week, the Church of England issued an apology to Charles Darwin. This was on top of its apology last year for its role in the slave trade. And those two apologies come after the late Pope John Paul II apologised to Galileo. So you never know what Christianity is going to confess to next. Maybe one day, maybe in 3008, they'll have apologised to Richard Dawkins. Who knows? Right, religion. It's got many definitions. I'll give you one, which is my favourite one. I've got to read this because I usually forget it. Religion is a human activity that can easily be accepted and understood, but only within the framework of the reality that it creates for itself. So if you accept the existence of a god or a spirit or whatever, or supernatural force that the various religions propose, then of course you've got no problem believing in what happens and what follows from that. However, most of the religions, most of the entities rather, or gods that religions propose, cannot have their existence validated by direct observation or reason. So in that sense, the emperor's got no clothes. You can make God up to be whatever you want it to be, and you will know when you've made God in your own image when he turns out to hate all the same people that you do. Now, as far as I'm concerned, all the available evidence points, of course, in favour of the discoveries of science. Big Bang, evolution, natural selection. I don't believe that there is an unseen hand in this, whether that's an alpha, omega creator, or an intelligent designer. An intelligent designer is a sort of creationist in a lab coat. David, of course, passionately believes that there is evidence there. I want to take just one thing tonight in the time available from his book, which I hope he's going to autograph for me later, and perhaps refund the cost. On page 69, he gives us the three alternative takes on our origins. He basically tells us to argue that something comes from nothing is, and I quote, beyond the realms of reason and a total nonsensical fantasy. He then goes on to argue that something was created out of nothing by a creator that had to be, and I quote yet again, incredibly powerful, intelligent, and awesome beyond our imagination. For that to be a creator who created something, to use the Latin ex nihilo, out of nothing. But I think then, in order to try and justify his argument, he resorts to making things up. He tells us that this creator exists outside time and space, and is the creator who crafts time and space and matter from nothing. Now my simple question is, how can you possibly know that? He then argues as to say that Dawkins is taking an incredible leap of faith, and it begs the question, who says that everything, including God himself, has to come from something? Well, I think, David, that you do, and I think so many religious people do. At least, they say something cannot come from nothing, but then they do a complete about turn and add, oh, except God. And then they do that because their imagination has had to invent explanations about dimensions that we don't know exist. You create the rule, and then trying to prove it, you break it in order to align it with what you imagine things to be. Now, if these dimensions outside time and space are unknown to us, then I don't know how you can possibly claim they exist, never mind that God or some supernatural force, some creator, exists within them. The creator is apparently awesome beyond our imagination, but then David claims that he can imagine it. If it's beyond our imagination, it's beyond our imagination. But he then goes on to imagine it. He imagines, for example, that it spoke 1,000 years ago to a man called Moses, although not in the 6th or 7th century to a man called Muhammad, presumably. He then says that it performed the world's first thoracic surgery to create a woman from a man's rib. He then says it had a son, that it delivered a system of moral authority, and most absurdly, in my view, that it is part of something called the Trinity. Now, a Trinity is a sort of celestial multiplication table, and it goes like this. 1 times 1 is 3, and 3 times 1 is 1. And according to the subtraction it does, if we take 2 from 3, 3 are left. And the addition is equally peculiar. If we add 2 to 1, we have 1. And he even ascribes properties to this mysterious force, such as mercy, compassion, and what have you. And all this he claims while telling us that actually this being is beyond our imagination, existing in dimensions that he's invented and he cannot hope to prove exist. So if I can use his own words against him, I think it's this, which is beyond the realms of reason and a total nonsensical fantasy. All I think David has done in his book is prove that God is all in the mind. God is imagined. He's a God of the guesses. He's put God in the same category as the fairies at the bottom of the garden. We can each make God up to be whatever we want it to be because we can. It's extremely convenient. David also argues entirely in his book from a Christian perspective, which I think also is a dead giveaway. You know, there's no quotes in there, supportive quotes from the Upanishads, or from the Quran, or from the Book of Mormon, or from the, you know, the ancient Egyptian Book of the Dead. And I think that's further proof that his arguments for God and God's existence are merely a reflection of his own prejudices and his own imagination. Now, none of this actually matters from my personal secular perspective. Aside from my personal views on whether God is a delusion or not, it's irrelevant to where I stand and where I come from. Another serious flaw in David's book is that he confuses atheism with secularism. Secularism is merely a neutral position that recognises that we all have different beliefs, but and argues that the only way we can happily live alongside each other is if no one of these hugely divergent beliefs is given privileged treatment by the state, which must be neutral on matters of religion. Now, there are many secularists who are also deeply religious people. Take, for example, the British Muslims for Secular Democracy. I don't think it's possible to be a Muslim and an atheist at the same time. Even the powerful and deeply pious Southern Baptists Convention in the United States would agree with me on this. A guy called Brent Walker, or J. Brent Walker, to give him his proper name, from its Joint Committee for Religious Liberty, said in the Washington Post this year, and this is a direct quote, "Atheists and agnostics are as moral, if not more so, than many people of faith. Secularism, properly understood, is not a bad word. Our US government should not be hostile to religion, but it must remain religiously neutral." So secularism doesn't set out to destroy religion. It's about allowing everyone to believe what they want in their personal lives, while not having one specific religion dictating in the public sphere how all of us should live our life. It's as much about freedom from religion as freedom of religion. But this is the area where I think the God delusion really does come into play in a practical sense. It really doesn't matter if David Robertson thinks I'm deluded because I don't believe in God. It really doesn't matter if I think he's deluded because he did, because he does. David will tell me, I'm sure, that his religious faith motivates him to get up in the morning. It gives him structure to his life, principles he's prepared to go to jail to defend, things he will even be prepared to die for. Well, I've got beliefs too. I have motivations. I have principles. But my principles aren't derived from belief in the supernatural. And the problem we currently have in this country and in other countries in the world is that one set of beliefs and principles appear to be given privileged treatment over another set of beliefs or principles just because they happen to be grounded in religion, in the supernatural. As the chair of the Equality and Human Rights Commission, Trevor Phillips, said last year, and he got a lot of flack for this, we are sleepwalking in this country towards segregation. I think that's because of the insistent demands of faith groups of all kinds for privileged treatment that's doing this. Segregated schools, segregated scout groups, parallel legal systems, or supplementary jurisdictions. That's what the Lambeth Ayatollah called it earlier this year when he got into a bit of trouble. So far this millennium, Christians and Muslims in Britain have even demanded segregated toilets. Now, that strikes me as a recipe for disaster. Why do we need to go to these great lengths? We even have the Lord's Day Observance Society determined to prevent Calmac ferry crossings to Lewis on Sundays so that that part of the island can be cordoned off for religious observance. The Stornoway Taliban seem to be alive and well, from what I can see. And I think that's the real danger about the God delusion, that it puts into practice what I think to be religion's first objective, which is to divide people. The saved and the damned, the righteous and the unrighteous, the believer and the infidel, the Jew and the Gentile. One group promised great riches and eternal happiness, the other group condemned to eternal torture and misery, both in this life and the next one, whatever that happens to be. So I think the God delusion leads to one group demanding special rights and privileges in what is a secular society, and it demands inequality. It's not secularists who demand exemption from equality laws so we can discriminate against people that we don't like. It's not secularists who demand segregated schools and then cheat on the admissions code to keep out the very people the religious say they love and want to help, in other words, the poor and the vulnerable. It's not secularists that seek to curb freedom of expression by demanding even tougher blasphemy laws than the ones that we've just repealed, the so-called defamation of religion law. And I think that's where, in practical terms, the God delusion actually hurts us as a society. It demands that in the name of respecting religious belief, we're increasingly being asked to tolerate the intolerant and become segregated through forms of institutionalized discrimination. Now, ladies and gentlemen, as I wind up, it would be remiss of me not to give my final words to one dead champion of the Scottish Enlightenment and one living. Now, standing in Edinburgh University, you can't get away without referring to David Hume, one of Edinburgh's most famous sons and philosophers, a man whom Edinburgh Christians successfully prevented becoming a professor here because of his atheism. Now, David Hume famously said, "A wise man proportions his belief to the evidence." And I think those should be your watchwords. A wise man, in my view, is not one who proportions his belief to the existence of a creator, where that existence can only be asserted by reference to being beyond our imagination and with reference to dimensions that we cannot possibly know exist. And finally, Scotland's greatest living and enlightened philosopher. Anybody know who that is? Audience participation time? No? Billy Connolly. Who else? Now, you've heard, no doubt, of Max Ehrmann and his Desiderata poem. It's the one that starts, "Go placidly amid the noise and silence and the haste, and remember what peace there may be in silence. as far as possible without surrender, be on good terms with all persons. Listen to others, even to the dull and the ignorant. They too have their story, as I'm telling you tonight. Well, Billy's version is just as good. As well as life-affirming and positive messages such as campaign against blue smarties, never wear tight underwear on aeroplanes, and the very, very astute, marry somebody you like. Billy also says this, avoid people who know the answer. Keep the company of people who are trying still to understand the question. And I think that's a very good basis for saying that faith in God is a delusion, and I move the motion. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Alistair McBeigh, for starting us off. Now I want to invite David Robertson to speak to us. David is the chaplain at Dundee University and author of the Dawkins Letters, which we've heard about, and also various historical books and articles. So, David Robertson.
Yeah, I'm also a Free Church minister, so keeping this to 15 minutes is going to be really difficult. I have no objection at all to Alistair calling me delusional. I accept about the Dundee bit, but because if my belief in God is wrong, it is delusional. And I'm sure he's not going to object too much if I say that his own faith is also, in my view anyway, delusional. We shall find out. The Apostle Paul said that if Jesus Christ has not been raised from the dead, then we are of all people to be pitied. So when we come to discussion, let's have none of this polite, you're all right. No, we're not. Someone's right, someone's wrong when it comes to this. It's great to be here. I'm a graduate of this fine university. I recall coming here when it was the library. I was an art student, and we had a strike one time to protect student grants. None of you will know what those were. But it was quite funny because the social science students, we had to, when we were occupying the library, we had to show the social science students where the library was, because the only time they'd use it was when there was an occupation of it. I stood for senior president of this university, and I'm quite intrigued that Alistair talks about the tolerance of secularism. I still have a chip on my shoulder because I was the favorite to win until the student newspaper shafted me because I was a Christian. The editor did not like Christians. And he used my Christianity, which I never used in a political speech ever, to say in the student newspaper that I was an extreme right-wing nut morally and an extreme left-wing nut economically. So I lost the Tories and I lost everyone else in one fell swoop. Kind of thinking about this in terms of what is a delusion, and I was kind of nervous coming down, so I cheered myself up by listening to Leonard Cohen and Nirvana, just to get me in the mood. There are all kinds of delusions. There is the delusion that our government seems to have had that banking chiefs will vote themselves a bonus cut because of the chaos they have created. There's the delusion that Hibs will win the European Cup. There's the delusion that I live by because I don't look in a mirror that I am handsome. There's the X Factor delusion. You ever seen that in the X Factor? It's hilarious. Someone comes on and they can't sing. And Simon Cowell or someone just hammers them. And they go off in tears and they come to the camera and say, I believe in myself. I believe I can win it, and so on. You're going, you can't sing. Get a life. You know, but we're kind of taught to have all these kind of delusions about ourselves. According to Webster's Dictionary, a delusion is something that is falsely or delusively believed or propagated. A persistent false psychotic belief regarding the self or persons or objects outside the self that is maintained despite indisputable evidence to the contrary. Now, where I agree with Alistair is I believe there's nothing so dangerous as a religious delusion, and there are plenty of them. My wife is a mental health officer across in Fife, and you quite often meet people who have delusions of grandeur. I personally have visited psychiatric wards, and I've met the devil, and I've met Mary, and I've met Jesus, people who are deluded into thinking that's what they are. My favorite story about that, actually, is in a particular church in Dundee where a man stood up and started shouting, "I'm Jesus, I'm Jesus," and started shouting at people. And this very astute woman stood up and shouted, "I'm Mary and I'm your mother and I'm telling you to sit down and shut up." Which I thought was quite a neat way to deal with it. A religious delusion I would describe as a philosophical belief or worldview which affects one's behavior, which is false. It's not real. It's not based on real evidence. It is a delusion. And I'm afraid I have to include in that the delusion of the atheist faith. Because atheism is a faith. I think everything is a faith in some sense. We all live by a combination of faith and reason. You cannot philosophically or literally prove to me that the whole world wasn't created yesterday and God just implanted in our brains all the history and all the everything else. I mean, no one can actually prove that. You can't prove that we're not in the matrix. How do you know that you are not really wired up to some kind of machine and this is just all a dream? It's all kind of a nightmare. In a sense, none of us can prove anything absolutely, so we all work by a process of faith and of reason together. My concern is that so many people consider that belief in God is de facto a delusion. Dawkins, for example, in his book The God Delusion, gives a definition of faith which no Christian would accept. But it's easy to argue against something when you put up the opposite point of view. He says this, that faith is belief in spite of or contrary to the evidence. Anyone who said, "I am a Christian, I believe in God," in spite of or contrary to the evidence, I would say, you're not a Christian. How can you possibly be a Christian? I myself tried very, very hard to be an atheist. When I came to university, I kind of almost wanted to be an atheist. But I couldn't, because it wasn't intellectually tenable. All the evidence that I could see was completely the opposite way. So people ask, why do you believe? Well, when I debate with some of my atheist friends, what they do is they continually ask for evidence, but their definition of evidence is so narrow that it makes it impossible to answer it, because their definition of evidence presupposes that there is nothing outside the materialistic. To me, that's a bit like using a football analogy. It's a bit like saying, okay, Dave, score a goal, and they give me a goal that's that size, and they give me a ball that's that size, and then they plonk themselves in front of the goal. Now, you can't win with that kind of attitude. It's very interesting when Christopher Hitchens debated John Lennox in Edinburgh during the festival. Lennox put in a wee trap. He mentioned the resurrection just as a fact. He didn't try and prove it or anything like this. Hitchens rose to the debate when it came to the rebuttal. He stood up and he said, "It won't take me 5 minutes to rebut someone who believes in resurrection." Why? Because for Hitchens, it's just an absolute that you cannot have, resurrection. Now, the whole point is, when we're talking about God, we're talking about the supernatural and so on. If you're saying that your starting position is de facto, there is no supernatural, then for you, there is no conversation. There is no dialogue. There is no argument. Because you've already predetermined that that cannot be the case. And that really is, that's a bit like trying to argue with somebody whose eyes are shut, saying, "I can't see anything, I can't see anything." It really is very, very, very difficult. So for me, what we need to ask, what we need to question, is the naturalistic, materialistic philosophy that says the only thing that we can know is what is material. Now, how do we prove that? I mean, basically, without getting too philosophical about it, I know this is the Philosophy Society and you'll hang me for this, but I actually like philosophy a lot. For a while, logical positivism seemed to make some kind of sense. But logical positivism hangs itself. Because logical positivism, which basically is arguing that only things that we can empirically prove can be real, that's itself a statement which you cannot empirically prove. So it self-defeats itself. So what you really end up with is people saying, if I can't see it, if I can't touch it, if I can't prove it in a science lab, then it can't exist. Well, I'm sorry, but I regard that as an extremely close-minded point of view. In fact, for that reason, I tend to see not all, and I wouldn't include Alistair in this, but most of the atheists that I debate with or know, they are as fundamentalist as any dogmatic fundamentalist religious group. Now, it's quite funny because you mention this on any atheist website, and bang, It's just absolutely incredible. I mentioned this down in Cambridge, speaking at Cambridge University, and I said that atheists get very emotional when you say this. And this man stood up, who was a lecturer, and started yelling at me. And I just thought, thank you, Lord. And he just kept yelling until his friend said, sit down, you fool, you're proving him right. Which, I mean, why was he so wound up about it? Because he wanted to think, I am open-minded and tolerant and reasonable, and all those who disagree with me are fundamentalists, dogmatics, religious types. So automatically you get excluded if you are religious. Well, some would say, okay, what's your evidence? I would have to say this, wouldn't I? I've got, at the end of the Dawkins letters, which was written as a response to the God delusion, because I'd been asked the question so much, I put down 10 reasons why I'm a Christian. The evidence for me is listed in there. We'll maybe get to discuss some of them. I would actually want to argue that it is, as the book of Romans says, delusional to ignore God and all the evidence for him. For example, my favorite philosopher is not a Christian. He's a guy called John Gray. If you've read Straw Dogs and Black Mass, please don't read them listening to Leonard Cohen or Nirvana with a glass of whiskey and a knife by your side, because you probably won't get through the night. They are incredibly depressing books because they describe the human condition. But he describes Dawkins as a Christian atheist, keeping the philosophy and the morality of Christianity without God. And he describes how illogical that is. In fact, he takes a very Nietzschean view of that whole idea. Now, John Gray has a very bleak view of humanity and sin. Actually, it's one that I think Dawkins shares a little bit. This is what Dawkins says about the universe. In The Blind Watchmaker, he says this: in a universe of blind physical forces and genetic replication, some people are going to get hurt, other people are going to get lucky. You won't find any rhyme or reason in it, nor any justice. The universe we observe has precisely the properties we should expect if there is at bottom no design, no purpose, no evil, and no good, nothing but blind, pitiless indifference. Nothing but blind, pitiless indifference. I would want to argue that what Francis Collins, who is an atheist, head of the Human Genome Project, convinced him of the truth of Christianity was the argument and the evidence from morality, that we can conceive of good and evil at all. I'd want to argue from the cosmological argument, the fine-tuning of the universe, that convinced Britain's and perhaps the world's most famous atheist, Anthony Flew, that there is a God. There is still hope for you, Alistair. I got a letter from a former president of the National Secular Society, who is now an Anglican vicar and a committed Christian. I look forward to welcoming you to the Free Church General Assembly fairly soon. My greatest evidence for God is just simply this. I hate religion. I really hate religion. I would find myself, when I hear statements from the National Secular Society coming from Alistair, a lot of the time I would say amen if it wouldn't offend him. But I find myself, I believe because of Jesus Christ. John Stott says this: I could never believe in God if it were not for the cross. In the real world of pain, how could one worship a God who was immune to it? I think that for me, the person and the work of Jesus Christ is for me what I believe in, what I trust, and all the evidence that I've seen for it. And I mean, believe me, it takes some hammerings, and you do try and be open-minded about it. I find it astonishing that people just automatically reject without ever knowing. At least people should attempt to try and find out. I want to finish with going back to Leonard Cohen. I heard him in a concert here in Edinburgh. I absolutely love Leonard Cohen. He's just an absolute genius. I'm not claiming as a Christian. I wish he was, but he sang this: like a bird in a wire, like a drunk in a midnight choir, I have tried in my way to be free, like a fish on a hook. I would argue that without God, and particularly without Jesus Christ, we are that bird on the wire. We are that drunk in the midnight choir, trying to be free but not being able to sing in harmony. We are that fish on the hook. And I would give Leonard Cohen his answer to that problem. How do you know freedom? What Jesus said. Know the truth, and the truth will set you free. And he also said that he was the truth. So I would argue belief in God is not a delusion. Belief in Jesus Christ is not always, at least, a delusion. And in fact, the delusion is to think that we can be free without him. Thank you.
Now I invite Alistair to respond for a few minutes.
Okay, I'm all right. I've been allowed to sit down for this one. David seems to have argued yet again from one perspective, that is a Christian perspective, and he still doesn't talk about what this other evidence is outside of the evidence that we can directly observe and validate. I've always found the business about the resurrection quite interesting, in as much as there are maybe in the New Testament, accounts written decades after the event, and we have to take the word of maybe 8 or 9 people at most that this event actually happened. Yet there was an entire race of people at the time who did not believe this man was the Son of God. They were the Jews, and they have been discounted. Their view has been totally discounted. And likewise, in 700 or thereabouts, there was another revelation to the Prophet Muhammad. And the Quran tells us that Jesus wasn't resurrected, didn't die on the cross, and further that the revelation to the Prophet Muhammad was going to be the last revelation, so he's not going to come again. Now, there may be 1 billion Christians in the world who believe that Jesus is the Son of God, died on the cross, was resurrected. There are 1 billion people in the world called Muslims who don't believe that, or at least they don't believe in his divinity, but they believe that there was a man who existed who was called Jesus. So the evidence that we do have out of what's observable seems to be entirely conflicting, in that we have 8 or 9 people in the New Testament who say this happened, and huge armies of people who say that it didn't. I'm not a philosopher. I try reading some, but I haven't got the grey matter for it, I'm sorry. That's probably because I support Dunfermline Athletic, which will tell you a lot more about me, as it will, as David has said to me in the past. I always like the one quote about philosophy, and I'm sure you've all heard this, it's probably first year student stuff. Philosophy is questions that may never be answered, whereas religion is answers that may never be questioned. And that's a view that I hold. I'd just like to wind up by telling the story. I went to a meeting in Glasgow last month of the new Equality and Human Rights Commission, where we all sat round the table, the religionists and the atheists, the Catholics, the Protestants, the pagans, the Hindus, the Sikhs, the Muslims. And I had sitting next to me a very nice man, a chaplain from a university, who was also a Church of Scotland minister. And he said to me privately over our cup of tea that he actually agreed with my position on a lot of things, and for one simple reason. He had no problem with his faith on a personal basis. He had no problem in his church with people who came to share that with him. His objection was organized religion, when a religion came out of the church and got politicized and got involved in society. That, I suspect, is what David means when he says a lot of religion he actually hates, and he says that quite openly in his book. I think, going back to the point I made at the beginning, it doesn't actually matter whether he's deluded or I'm deluded. It's how the God delusion, in the widest sense, impinges on the society that we live in and how we rub along together with each other. And I think the danger at the moment is that the God delusion leads to one group or several groups in society being privileged against others, and just has just led to, I mean, I think the faith community's strategy of the Labour government has led to a Me Too situation, where one religious group after another is queuing up to knock on the government's door to say, well, if they're getting that, we want this. And I think that's where the God delusion does us a great deal of harm as a society. That's all I've got to say. Sorry.
Well, you have to be a philosopher if you support Dundee. It's interesting. You see, you always get this argument about, you know, you can't be right because there are so many different religions. Let me quote what Plantinga says. If you insist that no one can determine which beliefs are right and wrong, why should we believe what you are saying? Why does your belief that that is the case, why should that be any more valid than any others? Tim Keller argues in his book, we are all exclusive in our beliefs about religion, but in different ways. And he goes on to argue, although many continue to call for the exclusion of religious views from the public square, increasing numbers of thinkers, both religious and secular, are admitting that such a call is itself religious. And here's the point of view. The point of view espoused by Alistair as regards saying, let's privatize religion, you know, as long as you do it behind closed doors, that's fine, but it mustn't come into the public square, is a religious view which only allows that one religious view to be the public view. And I think that that is authoritarian and wrong. Segregation is coming in this country because of the rejection of the Christian heritage and values by secularists. Our Christian heritage and values were ones of tolerance. But now when you get the kind of vehement fundamentalist approach of Richard Dawkins' The God Delusion, it is very exclusive. Witness, for example, that poor Anglican vicar who is an absolute evolutionary biologist who dared to suggest that perhaps it would be a good idea to discuss creationism in the science class when they were teaching evolution. He's gone. Why? Because that kind of viewpoint is not to be tolerated. I have to say, Alistair's right. Well, he's wrong, actually. He said, I had faith in religion. I have no faith in religion whatsoever. I do think that what I believe can be validated by reason and empirical evidence. Just going through his speech, I love the Big Bang. As a Christian, I believe in the Big Bang. In fact, it's been a godsend, literally, to people like me. Because before Big Bang theory, people generally believed that matter was eternal. Now we know the universe had a beginning. And that's resulted in the absolute fantasy of the multiverse theory, where Richard Dawkins says it's crazy to believe in a resurrection, but it's okay to believe that there's another universe in which you are already dead, and yet another one in which you have a green mustache. Now, he puts that forward as a serious proposition, and people go, oh, isn't that wise? And then they laugh when you say you believe an almighty God could have raised his son from the dead. Alistair asks a legitimate question. How can you know it? Well, I would argue very simply, two things. First of all, are we going to reduce reality to only that which we can know? That, for me, is an arrogant position. Secondly, we can know by revelation. And that becomes a big argument. Could God, if there was a God, could he reveal himself? By definition, I would argue that he could, and I would argue that he has. I do not put God in the same category as fairies at the bottom of the garden. And I do not accept that God is whoever you want him to be. I'm fed up, actually, of Christians going around saying, I read this book and it made me cry and God spoke to me through it and it was so wonderful and it was tosh. And you can say, no. I mean, of course, there's got to be truth and reality in that. I love, we talked about percentages of people. I don't know what this says, but I love this statistic. I've got to give it to you anyway. I know I've only got 1 minute and I'll waste a couple of seconds with this, but 14% of atheists, according to a poll last week in the United States, pray and say they believe in God. I love the rationalism of that. Religious faith does not motivate me to get up in the morning. Coffee does. I'm sorry, I don't get out of my bed thinking I have to get out of bed because God tells me to. That's not the way that it works. And I'm intrigued by the position on Karl Mack. I don't really want to discuss Sunday fairies when belief in God is a delusion. But as an example of secular intolerance, that's exactly it. When the majority of people in Lewis vote for a Sunday fairy, that's fine. But why should it be imposed by a secularist society saying, you must have this? That's a religious viewpoint. And I actually agree, avoid people who know the answer. That's the whole point about religion. You're continually, constantly questioning. We don't know the answer, but we know that there is an answer. Thank you.
We'll now move to a time of question and answer. If you want to raise any points from the discussion, please just raise your hand and come down to the microphone here, and we'll take the questions. Just come on down to the microphone whenever you're ready. Okay, come on down. And just make a cue. Okay, if you can just keep the question short, please, to the point, and make sure it's on the topic.
Alistair, do you not think that it's disingenuous to discard religion in the public sphere as being bad for society when this nation has benefited so much from significant social change born out of religious and specifically Christian convictions, for example, Wilberforce and the abolition of slavery?
Well, on the other side of that, the people that Wilberforce was arguing against, who wanted to retain slavery, with other Christians, So there's two sides to that one. Mm-hmm. I don't actually argue, I mean, David is wrong, but I don't argue that religious voices should be quietened and we shouldn't hear from them. Quite the opposite. Believe me, every time a reverend or a bishop or a cardinal or an archbishop stands up and says something, our membership spike goes like that. So I want them to say more all the time. They really are our best recruiting sergeants. Likewise, in terms of members in Parliament who are religious, and we have these arguments that brew up, such as the embryology bill and different religious viewpoints, where the Catholics are dead set against it, and the Jews turned the Jewish lobby said, "Well, no, actually, we have a different view of life to the Catholic view, and we think the Catholics are wrong." I think all these things should come out in the open. The problem I have with it is that there is still this hangover. Religion seems to want to go back to the days when it told us exactly what to do and we did it and we didn't ask questions. So I'm not saying that an MP leaves his religion at the door of the House of Commons when he goes in. Of course he's not going to do that. He's going to bring that in and it informs his view and all the rest of it. What I would say is that it's not his job once inside the door to argue for the merits of his religion over all others, and to only consider the outcomes for society on his religious perspective.
Okay. Do you want to follow up on that, David?
Yeah, just very briefly. I found it very interesting that when Tony Blair was asked about praying with George Bush in a very facetious way, Alistair Campbell came in immediately to protect him by saying, "We don't do God." Why? Because in this country, in our educational elites and in our media elites and in our political elites, to suggest that you have any kind of religious faith, you're going to end up in enormous trouble. And I think there is I accept Alistair's not like this, but I think there is a fundamental intolerance there. And I think we have to fight against that intolerance and allow people to express their philosophy publicly, whether they are atheist or whether they are religious in any form whatsoever.
Okay, let's move to the next question.
I'd like to question some people's definitions, really. Very quickly, I'll make a main point at the end.
Okay.
You refer to Richard Dawkins and other people like him as fundamentalist atheists, but I'm sure that as Richard Dawkins himself will tell you, and every atheist I've ever met, if there was evidence for God, we would be the first people to turn around and say, yeah, God does exist, we were wrong, which is kind of how I define a fundamentalist.
Dawkins says that in one of his books.
Okay.
Well, there you go.
Let's carry on.
Supernatural, you say that you rule out the supernatural. Philosophers tend to rule out the supernatural, but obviously, because if it happens in this natural world, then it's not supernatural, it's natural by definition. So, freedom.
Just speak up a little bit.
Sure, sorry. The freedom, you say that you can only find freedom through Jesus, but I don't understand how you can have a moral system that has rules from above handed down. Which restricts your reproductive rights, all kinds of things are being prescribed onto you. How is that more free than
plenty.
Not?
Thank you.
And the main point, okay. Sorry, I put it to the speakers
okay.
That any faith is a delusion, not just faith in God.
Okay, thanks.
Okay. Obviously, I would take half an hour to answer all that. I tend to think that the definition of a fundamentalist is somebody who says, I'm not a fundamentalist. If anyone disagrees with me, they're a fundamentalist. I mean, it seems to me that there are fundamental beliefs that people have. Indeed, all of us, to some degree, are fundamentalists. Some atheists I've met are very, very open to discussion, but others, the minute you deviate from their perspective, that's it. You are just... Go on the Dawkins website and dare to question and see what happens to you. Supernatural is natural by definition. No. Supernatural as a cause, we can argue that the supernatural intervenes and can work within. But just saying supernatural is natural by definition is, I think, just word games and doesn't really make a great deal of sense. And freedom for reproductive rights, that's very, very interesting. There are different kinds of freedom. You know, I personally don't have the freedom to fly by myself because that's not the way that I am made. Our freedoms are restricted in many different ways, and in reproductive rights, what I find absolutely fascinating, I know of a group called Atheists Against Abortion. But they are very, very, very unusual. And I'm thinking, why would anyone who has any knowledge of science at all want to argue, as some do in the United States, for example, for partial birth abortions or abortions up to term and all that kind of stuff? I think that's not freedom. And the whole question you put there of what is freedom and what is morality, I would love to know. Dawkins says without religion, there is very little basis for an absolute morality. If there is no absolute morality for me, there is no basis for morality at all.
Okay, so go on from there. Okay.
I always get amused when people say that atheism is a faith position. It's a bit like somebody telling me that the fact that I don't collect stamps is still a hobby. I've never quite managed to... I'm never quite able to get the philosophical grasp on that one. I think the point I wanted to make, actually, to the last speaker that I forgot, if you will indulge
sure.
me, is that
quickly.
It may be that Christianity has given a lot to us, but in the last 400 years, what has brought the enormous advances in humanity has been the reaction against Christianity. The Enlightenment, we're in the home of David Hume, for heaven's sake. So, you know, let's not say put hands up for one thing that has influenced society.
Next
Lots
question.
Of things have.
Okay, next please.
Okay, first of all, just a point of order, a point of information. Perhaps Francis Collins is a Christian, is
yes.
definitely a Christian. He
yes.
said he was an atheist.
No, he was an atheist. He became a Christian.
He said he is an atheist, I'm pretty certain.
No.
He's one of the most famous Christian scientists. Anyway, that was just a point of order. My question goes along these lines. You said that you know people who think that science is the only way to answer anything.
Yeah.
That's it. They don't accept. Have you ever really met, and my first part of the question, have you ever really met anyone that doesn't accept any evidence apart from science?
Yes.
Really? You've really met people who don't
yes,
believe in who don't believe in relationships with people or
no,
society?
They
or
do, but they believe
there is evidence. Wait a minute. That's my question.
Sorry, you asked a question.
Well, I'm not quite finished my question yet.
Finish up quickly.
Yeah.
Right, okay.
Have you really ever met anyone that doesn't believe that you can learn things from other people, you can learn things, you can know things like things that science hasn't answered yet, like love or anything like that? Have you ever really met anyone that doesn't believe in that? Secondly, you say that your scientific friends, your scientistic friends, perhaps you would say, they think that they have a very narrow definition of evidence. You said the thing about the football and all that.
Mm-hmm.
I think you have a too wide definition of religion. What is your definition of religion? You say that the NSS have a religious position because they oppose banning fairies on a Sunday. I mean, what exactly is a religious position then, if it doesn't include, you know, ritual and belief in supernatural things and
great,
and
thank you.
Okay. You forgive me saying I thought that was slightly confused. A religious position, you say it's too wide, and then you accuse me of saying it's not. If it doesn't include ritual and so on. A religious position I already described as a philosophical belief or worldview which affects one's behaviour. So, I would regard that as
I'm saying is I think a religion is something that includes ritual and such like. That's what I'm
yes.
saying.
I also don't know a single human being who operates without ritual of some form or other. As for your question, and I'm not sure it is a question because I thought it was more an accusation, that how is it possible, you know, do I really know someone who doesn't accept relationships and love and so on? Actually, I know plenty of people, plenty scientists. If you're a naturalist materialist, by definition, you are going to say that love is not a Daily Mail cartoon, but a chemical reaction. And I could name one top chemistry professor who, when I discussed it with her, she said to me, ultimately, David, that is correct. It is we can explain everything scientifically, and if we cannot explain it, we will be able to explain it. So the New Scientist magazine in the United States in the year 2000, now, here's a very interesting thing. They ran an article on, within a decade, they were arguing that we were going to have the theory of everything. There was going to be a scientific theory which would be of everything. That position has now retreated, mainly actually because of maths. And there are some German mathematicians who have developed mathematical formulas, which I do not understand, which basically say it is mathematically impossible to have a scientific theory of everything. But I know plenty of people who would argue that love, relationships, and all the rest of it can be explained through evolutionary biology, through chemistry, through observable science. So,
let's go on. Alistair, do you want to speak to that? Or just move on?
Well, no, actually, just move on.
Move on?
Yeah.
Okay, next question, please. Okay. Thank you.
My question is for...
If you can speak up, please. Thank you.
Oh, sorry. My question is for David Robertson. Yeah. So, according to your opponent, you wrote in your book that that you couldn't have... let me rephrase this. That we don't have that we couldn't possibly have a concept of God. He's, like, beyond our conception. But then there seems to be a problem then with any sort of belief in God, because to me it seems that before you can... have a belief in something, you have to first have a concept of it. Having a concept of something seems like a prerequisite before you can actually believe in it. But then you have already claimed that you do believe in God, but yet God is beyond your conception. So I don't see how you can possibly reconcile that without either getting rid of the fact that you believe in God or the fact that you don't have a concept of God.
Okay. Can we get the question at the back there? Yes or no? Yeah? Okay, great.
It's a great question. I was going to say next. No, it's a great question. My argument would be very, very simple. There are lots of things that I am aware of that I don't necessarily have a concept of or couldn't articulate. I would also argue this. When I write in the book about God being a concept that I cannot fully understand or fathom, I don't have any problem with that. I don't understand the mechanics and engineering that allows me to fly in a plane. I hate flying. And I honestly sit in the plane and I logically work through the fact that there are millions of planes that have flown, they haven't crashed, and then I think about the ones that have and all the rest of it and work it through. Because I cannot explain to you how that plane works, it doesn't mean to say that it doesn't work. So I would argue that the concept of God, when I say I have a concept of God, it's impossible to have a concept of God in the sense of completely understanding who God is. That is not the same as saying that you can have no thoughts about God at all. In fact, the two most interesting philosophical questions are, why is there something rather than nothing? And the other one is, why do human beings have any concept of God at all? Dawkins admits, along with Dorothy Kellman and others, that children are innate creationists, and they have to be educated out of it, and that they are innate theists. I would argue they're innate theists because, as C.S. Lewis argues, you know, a duck quacks, a fish swims, and human beings have a desire for sex because there is such a thing as sex. I would argue that human beings have a God consciousness because there is such a being as God, and that's where that's actually the starting position I would take. So it's a good question. Thank you.
I always think it's dangerous when you get into areas like definitions and concepts. We all end up disappearing up our own fundamental orifices quite quickly, and we don't actually resolve anything. David talks about concept. Let me just read you one bit from his book. He talks about, in terms of morality, he says, why do we have a sense of good and evil? What is evil? Unlike Dawkins, I cannot believe in the innate goodness of human beings. I see too much evil, and no explanation fits what I observe as neatly and realistically as the teaching of the Bible. I also find the Bible brings us the answer to evil, and I've not yet come across any philosophy which does so. Now that may be David's concept, it's not mine, and if you want to have a separate debate on this next week and schedule about 6 hours, then we'll do it. Yeah. But I don't think you should get hung up on that too much, because I don't think it will get us anywhere.
Could I as well, can I just respond very briefly to that, the point you made earlier about the Enlightenment bringing, you know, moral improvement and so on. I do strongly recommend that you read John Gray, because John Gray argues that in actual fact the Holocaust and the 20th century Stalinism and so on is actually a product of the Enlightenment. And it's a very fascinating argument that he makes. Neil Ferguson, who's just a fabulous historian, where he talks about the 20th century as, his book on the 20th century as, history's age, the war of the world, history's age of hatred. And again, he doesn't go quite as far as Gray, but again, he's arguing it stems from the Enlightenment. So okay. The Enlightenment's kind of all cool and sexy in some ways, but actually maybe Enlightenment values also had a negative side as well.
We'll move on from there. Okay, so let's make sure we're sticking to the topic here. Is faith in God a delusion? These historical matters are important, but we want to stick to the topic. And it'd be great to have some... any ladies who want to ask a question as well? A lot of blokes up here. Ladies, come. There we go. Great. Fantastic. Maybe we can have a lady come to the front. Thank you. Okay.
My question is to you. Did I understand correctly that you said you distinguish between a belief in God and a belief in fairies at the bottom of the garden or other supernatural beings? And I was wondering how you distinguish between one thing for which there is no evidence and another thing for which there is no evidence, and why those two things are different.
Well, obviously you preloaded the question. It's a bit like asking me, you know, when did you stop beating your wife? Because you preloaded the question by presupposing that there is no evidence for either. And on that basis, the question is nonsensical, because obviously I do not accept the presuppositions of the question. So I'm arguing, and I've argued precisely, and I argued in my talk, that there's plenty evidence for the God of the Bible.
I think she means valid evidence.
Yeah, evidence that...
Well...
Okay, it's fine.
Indeed, but you see... Of course, but you see, again, here come the presuppositions. That's exactly what I argued in my talk, that you ask for evidence and then predetermine what is valid and what is non-valid. Now, I say that there is plenty valid evidence. If you come to this argument with the view that there can be no valid evidence because there is no God, in other words, the classic example is, say, resurrection. People start, resurrections don't happen. Therefore, anyone who claims that there's a resurrection, there has to be another explanation. What you've done is you've predetermined, and some people call that prejudice, but you predetermined that that must be the case. Now, that is as fundamentalist as any religious person who comes predetermined that there is a God.
So what's your answer?
My answer is the evidence is there.
And you need what is it?
Okay, well, there's I list 10 things in the back of the book. There's if you want to, I'll read them. Well,
one example.
Okay,
any of them.
Is this your question? Next person.
Okay, fine.
Okay. Well, one of the ten
okay. is just simply the fact that human beings have a moral concept. That would be one of the ten.
That's evidence for God.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Dawkins himself says that without God, it's very difficult to have any absolute morality. I would argue that philosophically, if you don't have an absolute morality, you have no morality, ultimately.
Okay.
So the fact that we have a concept of morality is itself an evidence. In the same way, you know, I'm not sexually obsessed, but I would use sex as an example. The fact that human beings have a desire for sex, for me, it's a pretty big indicator that there may be such a thing as sex. And I would argue the same in terms of our desires for God. Now, you can perhaps explain it away in different means, but it is not good to automatically dismiss an argument like that, say, that's not evidence. You need to look at what is being said. What I find is that 21st century secularists are far, far different from atheists, say, like Bertrand Russell, who at least gave considered attention to the arguments and didn't just dismiss them, saying, well, they can't be right.
Okay. Let's move on. Okay. Next question.
I'd just like to say that I think actually we have considered the evidence and dismissed it as not valid. And I think I'd just like to say also that there is actually evidence for the existence of fairies at the bottom of the garden, because every time it rains, that's when the fairies are crying.
We'll take our next question.
Okay, I know I'm a middleman here, is a bit of a time lord, so I'm going to hurry this along. Basically, is faith in God a delusion is the title of the talk. Right. Now, sorry, I've forgotten your name.
Alistair.
Sorry, Alistair. I am genuinely terrible at names at the worst of times. Is faith in God a delusion? It's basically, in very general terms, asking, is God real? Now, it's very easy to answer that if you are an atheist, because we take God to mean any God. Thor, Zeus, this guy here. So, what's your name? So you're answering the charge on Christian grounds.
Uh-huh.
Now, go back. You have not given us any real satisfactory explanation. Is faith in God a delusion? You obviously would say no.
Uh-huh.
But why? Why would you say it's not?
Because, the reason I would say it's not, because the overwhelming evidence that we have throughout human history and that we currently have at the moment points towards there being a God. I've mentioned morality. I would argue from history. I would argue from the Bible. I would argue from our concept in our own heads of eternity. I would argue I certainly wouldn't go the ontological argument. I would argue cosmology. I would argue the fine-tuning of the universe. I would argue the same evidence that drove Anthony Flew away from his atheism, and you need to read his book, because it was the evidence he said his opinion has always been, even when he wrote his most famous atheist books, was, I go where the evidence leads me. And he is now convinced, he's not a Christian, though he does say of all the forms of religion, the Christian religion seems to him to make the most sense, though he has not yet professed himself to be a Christian. He has certainly professed himself to be a theist. Now, I would argue, it's very, very easy for people to ridicule. I would say, please be very careful about that, because it does come across as remarkably arrogant. Here's a man who has been arguing for atheism, who's one of Britain's greatest philosophers, been studying it for years and years and years, and this is not an argument from authority, but he turns around and says, actually, the evidence has led me to this. Now, I would say, don't be so dismissive. It may be that you examine the evidence and say, no, I'm sorry, but that evidence is not there. But don't start with the presupposition that there can be no evidence.
I did not start with the supposition there was no evidence. Your evidence, for example, there being a morality, mm-hmm. is switch. I could just as well say that that is evidence that there is not a God.
Why?
Because the fact is that God, his morality is based on might is right. God could just as well easily say that killing is absolutely right, and that would then become morality. So by invoking the absolute morality of a God, you're actually giving complete arbitration to the God and taking it away from human beings. So I might argue, and chimpanzees have a morality, so where's their chimpanzee God that gives it to them?
Okay,
Every one of your evidence...
Do you want to come back on that quickly?
Yeah, sure, absolutely. Again, it's a complete misunderstanding. If you're going to argue against a position, you need to know what you're arguing against. And the Christian view of morality is not might is right. In fact, ironically, the might is right comes from Nietzsche's philosophy because of his rejection of the Christian view of morality.
But that's not might is right morality, that's a master and slave morality.
Do you want to come on that?
Yeah, there's a lot of assertions flying around, like, you know, who says the universe is fine-tuned? How do we know these things?
Virtually every cosmologist that exists.
Something like, you know, Antony Flew goes across the other to the other side, but there are people that go the other way. And yes, cosmologists may exist that, but they are scientists who propose a hypothesis, evaluate it against the evidence, and change it. Accordingly, it will either stand or fail. But asserting that there is a God takes the opposite approach. It starts with the answer and then looks for the evidence to fit, which I think is what David does.
Okay. Yes, please. And again, if any more ladies who want to come up, don't feel intimidated by all these men at the front. I'm sure you wouldn't, but go for it.
Hi, David. This is a question directed to you.
Okay.
You claim that there are things that exist that we may not know or cannot know, right?
Yeah.
With reason, right?
Yeah.
So, but then you also claim that you believe in your belief because God has revealed that to you. But I'm also thinking there are also many other religious people,
yeah.
who of different faiths who have been revealed by their version of this God, or even maybe atheists, they have been revealed by some force. I don't know. I'm not saying that whatever. My question is, how do you know they're delusioned and you're not? I mean, maybe you're all delusioned.
Great, yeah. Thank you.
It's a great, great question, and maybe every single one of us is deluded. My argument would simply be this. I think your question is extremely valid, and I think every single person, whether religious or not, and I would argue all of us have religious and philosophical views, even if we claim to be atheists, we should all be prepared to put up our hands and say, actually, there's a lot of things we don't know, and we could be wrong. Could I be wrong? Yes. I fully accept that. I speak a fair bit at the Islamic Society in Dundee, and it's a big challenge to my own faith, because the stereotype of Muslims that I have, it's very easy when I don't know and talk to them, but one lovely Muslim lady came up to me after a talk I gave, and she had the full works on the burqa and everything, and she said, "You're amazing." She said, "You're the first Christian I've ever heard who says he believes in the Bible as God's word and creation and so on." She said, "You're almost a Muslim." I said, "Well, maybe you're almost a Christian." So the presupposition behind your question is we should all question. My job as a minister is simply this. My job is not to tell people what to believe. My job is to get people to think. And I would argue that's what we should be doing here.
Well, I think in David's book, he takes on some occasions the opposite approach. You know, he certainly, according to this book, isn't wrong about Jesus. He's absolutely right about Jesus. So again, you're straying into that area of philosophical inquiry about what's right and what's wrong and you know, and what isn't.
Yeah.
It is a difficult one. I'm not clever enough to work it all out. So I mean, take it away, folks. You know.
Yeah. I mean, here's the problem, Alistair. You see, I'm sure my wife will forgive me for saying this. But sometimes she says to me, if we're having an argument, which occasionally does happen, even in our perfect Christian home, sometimes she will say to me, "You always think you're right." And I go, "Yeah, duh, of course. Why would I say it if I didn't think I was right?" But that can come across as incredibly arrogant. You don't argue for a position if you don't think it's right. What I would say to you, Alistair, is simply this. If you could give me evidence or show me Jesus' bones, my faith is finished. You know, that's it. It's done. I was wrong. Is it possible I've got it wrong? Yes, of course it's possible I've got it wrong. But I would just ask everyone to have the same courtesy. Maybe you've got it wrong as well. And I do notice that most of the Christians I deal with don't have the degree of certainty that most of the atheists I deal with.
Okay, let's go on.
Firstly, I'd like to apologise for not asking you a question, that, because you haven't got any yet, and I feel that's a bit unfair, but I couldn't think of one. So, yeah.
Yeah. Do you fancy a pint afterwards? Would be a good one to ask.
I love it.
And I was in a queue for quite a bit, so yeah. Sadly my question's been semi-asked, but thankfully not answered at all. So,
okay. Thank you.
The title of the debate is... Is faith in God a delusion? Mm-hmm. And there has been a lot of focusing on the God bit, but it's rather interesting with the use of the word faith. Mm-hmm. You talked about we all have faith, mm-hmm. and I think in one sense of the word faith that seems to be true, but don't you think there's a bit of an equivocation going on there between the way you'd say I have a faith that the sun will rise tomorrow? That's mm-hmm. rather different from a very organized philosophical set of beliefs like a religion.
Okay, again, a good question. You're assuming that a religion is an organized philosophical set of beliefs. I have to tell you this. I became a Christian just when I came to Edinburgh University. Really annoyed me because I basically came to enjoy my hedonistic freedom and even to study. But being a Christian changed all of that. For me, in 25 years of being a Christian, it has never been an organized set of beliefs. It has been disorganized chaos in lots of ways. So I don't accept, again, your definition of... That may be a definition of some philosophical viewpoints and religious viewpoints, but I don't think it's a definition of the faith that I'm talking about. Faith for me is very simple. I do have faith that my wife loves me. I can't put that down in a formula. I can offer some degree of evidence for it, but I can't put it down as a formula, as a set of beliefs. I also have faith in Jesus Christ. Again, I'm not prepared to put that down as a formula, though I do think it includes definite beliefs and experiences.
Can I just ask a quick little question aside? Do you believe the Bible is the Word of God?
Yes.
And that's a belief?
Yes.
And it's a book that was compiled through an organized process and is used to systematize and gain contact between the divine. That sounds like an organized belief.
No. In fact, again, it's a misunderstanding of the Bible. I'm by training a historian. That's what I studied here. The last thing the Bible is an organized process. It was written over a period probably of about 2,000 years. I mean, I love it. It's the kind of Da Vinci Code, Dan Brown view of the Bible that Dan Brown puts at the beginning of the Da Vinci Code at the Council of Nicaea. There was a tied vote about which parts of the Bible to accept and which not to accept, and the Emperor Constantine had a vote on it. It's absolute rubbish. It was like 600-2 or something, and they weren't deciding on the content of the Bible. Actually, the writing of the Bible is, again, absolutely chaotic. But out of that chaos has come something. Now, of course, some people will presuppose, well, the Bible's all rubbish, and other people presuppose it's got to be true. I have to say this. There are parts of the Bible I really, really, really struggle with. But I've studied it as a historian as well as a theologian for over 25 years. I'm more than ever convinced of its truth historically and so on. There are bits in the Bible I'd want to say, right, okay, no, that didn't really, I couldn't know. And I've got the top five that usually get brought up when I debate on borders and, you know, you just think, okay. But Bible is the last thing the Bible is an organized set of beliefs. And anyone who tries to make it that is going to find themselves in deep trouble.
Okay. I'd love to go on, but...
Yeah, thanks. Good questions. Yeah,
last
thanks.
Two questions quickly now, please. Can we have them both together, please? Is that all right? Just give your questions one after the other. Thanks.
My question's to David again. Yeah. Sorry, Alistair. But I was just
you could answer it for me.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Oh, sorry. Right. Just drawing on that central contradiction that Alistair has been trying to point out to you about tolerance.
Yeah.
Because you said that you're trying to defend Christian tolerance without kind of being tolerant, which I find a bit odd. Because the whole fairy example... You're saying that it should stick to the Sunday. Why are we saying that we should impose our beliefs and say no? We should have the fairy on the Sunday. But why can't the secular society give the choice? I don't understand where the problem with choice is.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay. I can answer that very, very simply.
And the second question first.
Oh, sorry.
Quite different. My question is quite different.
Can I just answer that very quickly? Very quickly. It may be that Asda want to open a supermarket at the end of my street. And the whole local community is against it because they don't want to be 24/7 shopping. Would you argue, in the sake of tolerance, that has to be the case? No, I would argue for local democracy in that sense. And I do not think that anyone has the right to impose values on a community which that community does not hold. I personally have no problem with travelling on a Sunday, and I do it frequently. I'd be a hypocrite if I lied otherwise. If I lied otherwise, there's a Freudian slip. But I think it's incredibly intolerant to seek to impose values on a different community from outside. I know plenty of people in Stornoway who have moved there. I remember hitchhiking there, I thinking like you did. And this guy says, oh, I'm not a Christian, I hate all that stuff. But he says, I love the Sabbath stuff here because all the shops are closed and it's great. Now, that's their choice. Don't impose a secularist morality upon them against their will.
Okay.
Very quickly to Alistair to make a change. You kind of, given the resurrection is often the one of the foremost arguments put forward as evidence of God's existence in terms of Jesus, God raising Jesus from the dead, you kind of dismissed it very summarily and basically equating a 600 years later source as equivalent historically with a source.
A revelation.
Okay, a revelation, but which is still. I don't accept it as that, but. Right. You didn't seem to kind of engage with the evidence for the resurrection from the time, such as why the body was never produced, why it was how the kind of Christian community managed to grow so rapidly based on what must have been a lie if it didn't happen. I was wondering if you had a kind of response to kind of, I mean, you even yourself admit that it was decades after the records, so that's still within the lifespan of people who were around at the time. So it wasn't just nine people, it would have been a whole community of people that could have said, actually, no, here's the body. Have you got any kind of... that you'd like to elaborate on that.
Okay, well, can I go back and respond to the first question first, and I'll come back to that one. When we were talking about the ferry service to Lewis, David originally said, you know, when all the people on Lewis all vote, you know, for it, then we'll have it. And then before that, he had said that might is right is not the Bible's message. It's got nothing to do with what a particular community wants. I think there'd be an outcry if a Muslim community or a Hindu community in a part of Britain said, we're doing this on this particular day, therefore all the cars and we'll stop all the traffic coming in and blah, blah, blah. I don't think that's the case at all. There is a large group of people on Stornoway who do want that ferry service. You know, if you want to sit inside and read a Bible and not go to the shops, even if you're an atheist and you just want to sit inside and enjoy the peace and tranquility, you can. You're not forced to go to the shop. Taking the second question now... evidence. Yeah, there's an interesting guy in the United States called Dan Barker, who's also referred to in this book, and I only say that to prove to David that I have read it all the way through. that was a struggle. Dan Barker used to be an evangelical preacher, a real dyed-in-the-wool tub thumper, worked with Pat Boone, who was a great evangelist himself in the US. And Dan Barker is now the chairman or president, whatever you want to call him, of something called the Freedom From Religion Foundation in America. And Dan Barker has, over many years, set a problem for Christians, which is for people to write to him with a strict chronological sequence of events surrounding the crucifixion and the resurrection, particularly Easter, without leaving out a single fact out of the various descriptions of it in various chapters of the Bible. He's issued that challenge to countless religious people, and nobody's ever taken him up on it, which will tell you something about the nature of the evidence. Now, I don't know if... Maybe there's been a TV program on this, I don't know. Maybe there has been one of these mock trial things where the evidence for... the resurrection has been put up there with a barrister for and a barrister against and my learned friends. I don't know. What I'm saying is, to the extent that there is evidence in the Bible, it is conflicting and it's written many years after the event. And I don't think it's reliable as such and would probably be dismissed in a court of law. But there you go. Try Dan. Have a look for Dan Barker and see if you can do his the answer to his... problem that he sets. Okay. You know Dan, don't you?
Yeah, I can help you with that. This is the Dan Barker myth. It's like the Christopher Hitchens myth. Hitchens is meant to have asked a question that no one can answer, and it's been answered numerous times. Same with Dan Barker. If you want to know the answer to it, John Wenham, the Easter Enigma, puts together the four different accounts of the Gospels. By the way, as a historian, that's one of the reasons I believe the Gospels. If someone had come with four bits of four documents which were identical, I just think you just copied each other. But the fact that they are so different in their perspectives is, for me as a historian, actually remarkable evidence in terms of what they're asserting. That they are eyewitness accounts. Richard Bauckham, Jesus and the Eyewitnesses, professor in St Andrews University, I'd recommend that one as well. But if you want the Dan Barker question answered, just read The Easter Enigma by John Wayne.
The Easter what, sorry?
Easter Enigma.
Enigma. Right.
Which is trying to explain the apparent contradictions that are there.
I shall seek further enlightenment.
Thank you.
Just give you 2 minutes to wrap up.
May the force be with you.
Any final comments? Yeah.
That was my line. That was what I was going to use at the end. You've stolen my thunder. I'd just like to say how much I've enjoyed it. I think it goes back to what I said before. It really doesn't matter, you know, whether David thinks I'm deluded or he's deluded. I think the problem comes in the practical way that we approach these things in our daily lives. I still think we'll be arguing about this one forever. But I think one of the key issues is the vast majority of us, I think, will have these arguments and debates and discuss, but we'll all rub along quite happily to a greater or lesser degree. There are idiots on both sides. David and I were talking earlier before we came in here. He has a loathing for Stephen Green, the Christian Voice. And I think it's bad news that the media, for example, seem to quote Stephen Green from Christian Voice all the time as some sort of expert on the Christian view of Britain. There are also idiots on the atheist side. But they are, I think, in the minority. I think the vast majority of us can go away quite happily and meet up and have a few beers or whatever and not worry about it. So I'd encourage you to do the same and try not to be too fundamentalist and too extreme.
The Apostle Paul was speaking in front of a king one time, and the king said to him, "Do you think that in such a short time you could persuade me to be a Christian?" Alistair, as I say, because I believe in God, I believe in the Holy Spirit and so on, and I'm serious about this. I will actually and do actually pray for you. I have known atheists who have become Christians. I've also known people who are professing Christians, like Dan Barker, who have turned around and denied their faith, so you could quote on both sides. I do want to make a plea for tolerance in that respect. And again, I find it interesting how selective the argument is, taking the Sunday Fairies thing is just as a thing, saying, well, people let people choose. But unfortunately, if you're a worker, you don't get the choice. That's it. You will, if your boss decides you are doing this, that's it. And I think one of the problems in our culture is the 24/7 permanent culture. I think we need to sort out some things along those lines. So I certainly would argue for tolerance. I definitely want to argue for thinking. I want to argue for Christians to think as well. It's embarrassing sometimes when Christians come up with answers that they've got out of a how-to book. You know, how to witness to atheists. How to witness. Throw it away. Think for yourself. But I've also come across the atheist equivalent continually, where the same arguments come up all the time. And there's a great deal of emotion that gets involved in this. And I'm just saying, look, seek the truth. Question all the time. I love, in kind of summarizing this, the whole is belief in God a delusion? I love what Stephen Hawking says, where he says, in A Brief History of Time, it would be very difficult to explain why the universe should have begun in just this way, except as the act of a God who intended to create beings like us. I find that a fascinating quote, because The Brief History of Time is the most bought, unread book in the world. You have it on your coffee table, and you go, oh, you've got The Brief History of Time, and even The Briefer History of Time, people don't really read it. It's a very difficult and complex book, and the reason it is because Hawking will not accept. It is very difficult to explain why the universe should have begun in just such a way, except as the act of a God who intended to create beings like us. Fascinating that Hawking has finally come out and said he does believe that everything came from nothing. Now that, philosophically, I'm jumping through hoops trying to grasp where he comes from. I am personally persuaded, Arno Penzias, the Nobel Prize winner who discovered the Big Bang, the best data we have are exactly what I would have predicted had I nothing to go on but the five books of Moses, the Psalms, the Bible as a whole. I would just simply make this plea. If you are an atheist or an agnostic, do not come with the presupposition that because you are a Christian or a religious person that you have necessarily left your brain behind you. You haven't thought these things through. I would argue that there's a lot more evidence than a lot of people seem to think for the existence of God. When someone says, David, why are you a Christian? Why do you believe? My argument is very, very simple. It's not because of some experience I had. That's part of it, if you like. My argument as to why I'm a Christian is because it's true. Now, you can turn around and say to me, well, David, it's not true. And so we just stand there and yell at each other. And sometimes that's the level of the argument. Well, okay, let's actually seriously look at the evidence. But do not predetermine what you will accept as evidence. Because that's the argument. The argument is about the philosophical viewpoint that you're taking, the worldview that you have. I'm prepared to say there may be no God. I'm also prepared to say that there could be a God. In fact, I obviously believe that there is. And I'm saying, look. And if you do look for him, you will find him. Okay, thank you. Thank you.
As we close, I'm just going to ask Hannah Kelly and Andy Dyack to come up. They're the president of the Christian Union and Philosophy Society, respectively. And just going to say a few words of thanks and so on. Who's going first? Andy, go first.
First, I'd just like to start by thanking both the speakers on behalf of Philosophy and personally. This sort of debate is something that it's going to continue to happen. I don't think any of us are going to stop talking about it after we've heard what they say, and it's something we should talk about, and I hope everyone here does go away and talk about that. I would like to thank the CU. They've done a tremendous amount of work for this, in particular Simon Milligan and Jack Charnley, who's basically put the whole thing together, and I'd like to invite you to join me in thanking them. And I'll just hang over to Hannah.
Thank you, Andy. I just want to say on behalf of the Christian Union a huge thank you to both speakers for joining us here this evening. It's been a great opportunity to dialogue and debate together. I'd also like to say thank you to Josh for chairing the debate. As ever, just your help has been fantastic, so thank you. Also like to say thank you to Andy and the Philosophy Society and all the stewards, you're in various places. Thank you so much for your help. It's been such a delight to partner with you in putting on these debates over the last couple of years and to really ask questions together. I think that's so important that we ask questions together, especially whilst we're at university and have the opportunity to do that. So I'd just like to ask you to join with me in thanking the Philosophy Society and Josh.
The last word of thanks, if you wouldn't mind, for Stephen and his technical team, who very kindly put this event on. Do please look out for upcoming events in the future, and do stay for hot chocolate now. Thank you.
Guys, sorry, before you go as well, can I just say this? I know there's lots of questions and things. You can either get my email address off me, my card. If you buy the book, it's in the back of that as well, so that's the thing. But I'm very, very happy for people to write questions, because I really do want to hear what you've got to say, and it's a good way to continue the dialogue, so feel free. Okay. Thank you.